And it is 12:02. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial, WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM. Coming up any moment now. Victor Rose's card again. But more than that, Night Shift with Mike Sargent. Special guest Eugene Bergman, author of Excelsior, You Fathead, a book on the life and times of Gene Shepherd, great radio personality of our youth. Stay tuned.
Oh, no.
Just itsy bitsy little corks bobbing in a fantastic maelstrom of our own making. Because you see, if we didn't have that maelstrom, do you realize how dull it would be? I mean, if there was no trouble in the world, what would you do? You just sit on your duff and wait for it to happen. Death. You just sit there. Nothing, you know? And so trouble is actually the true pleasure in the world. It really is. If you don't think so, pick up The Average magazine and find out how many stories are about happiness and how many are about trouble. Just mix them up and put them together. And you will find that trouble equates happiness. And happiness equates trouble. And there are many, many very ancient Eastern philosophers who have made that observation. That without trouble, a man is no man. And of course, without man, there is no trouble. They are inseparable. They go and they march side by side, one and the other, one and one, throughout the pages of history. All of history is nothing but trouble. It's nothing but a gigantic diary of problems, gigantic, enormous fistfights. And, of course, then we had the 100 Years' War. Well, actually, it hasn't been a 100 Years' War. It's been more like a 2-million-year war. Been much more than just 100 years. And we always have this great belief that somehow one day it's all going to stop. Well, when it all stops, there just won't be any people left. That is the final solution. There's no such thing, you know, as a non-carnivorous carnivore. They just don't exist. This is another one of the problems of people. They like to think that a tiger who purrs is somehow not a tiger. And a tiger who nuzzles up against you, you know, and rubs back and forth, is still not a, he's not a tiger anymore, you know? It's like this poor, sad book about the lion that has recently been making... You know, the psychological reasons why people are fascinated with the idea of this lion, you know this thing of the lioness, where these people took the lion cub and they finally took her back to the jungle, and they... And the idea being that she really isn't a lion, she's just one of us, you know. And, yes, sir, that's my baby. Sir, don't mean maybe. Again, it's a part of the old illusion that man is perfectible, as are tigers and lions. Well, we couldn't possibly enjoy a lion. The reason we like that lion is because that lion went immediately back into the jungle and began to kill zebras. Hence, became a true lion. Then she became a bestseller. If the book had been written that this lion made the grade, crossed over, passed, and became one of us, went back to the jungle, and was killed by a zebra, the book wouldn't have sold 3 copies. So we really don't want to change gold into lead, nor vice versa. That we would honestly begin to hate lead if we could change it to gold. And we would certainly have no respect for gold if we changed it to lead. And along with this, the great belief of the assembled multitude of united old ladies of all history who have believed that somehow man has a transistor circuit in him that one day is going to be fixed on a little adjustment and he will cease to be a carnivore. And, sir, that's my baby. No, sir, don't mean maybe. Yes, and another thing. There are no non-combatants in this war. It is true that there are PFCs and there are generals. And it's quite true. But there ain't no civilians in this war. It has gone on, how long do they say now? 2 million years, maybe, they say man has been on Earth. 2 million years. You know, there was a historic moment that was recorded by one of the great physical anthropologists at the University of Pennsylvania. And he has reconstructed it. I thought you might like to know about it. It was one of the great... It was the time that man became man. It was a very important moment. These two guys were sitting on the shores of this antediluvian lake, an ancient primeval water. And you know, in those days, it was interesting. There were no trees. Have you noticed New York is becoming a city of trees now? You notice that? It's very pleasant over there on Fifth Avenue. One day, not long ago, something happened to the shoulder of a guy's washable, wearable Dacron suit. Just dropped right out of the sky from a tree above him. And it wasn't a pigeon that did it. It was a bluebird. And somehow, he just... funny thing, I was with the guy, and I said, aren't you going to take it off? I mean, aren't you going to wipe aren't you going to do something? He says, no, I'm going to leave it there. It was a bluebird. And the bluebird of happiness finally did it on his shoulder. A bluebird, right here on Madison Avenue, right flying over there by Fifth and into the plane trees, right there offshore, right there next to where the waters of Gitche-Gumee lap up there next to the great fountain of Rockefeller. Choom, choom, just washes back and forth there. But, you know, well, you're interested in the story, huh? I mean, you want to know how we came to be? Oh, come on now. That's not important, is it, really? Of course not. We are what we are. I will award the brass figurine with bronze oak leaf palm to the one of you. One of you. And I want it to be a chick this time. I've noticed this, that men answer questions. Chicks sit there with roguishly dancing, enigmatic eyes and say, listen to this idiot. Well, I have a sneaking suspicion that there are some underground idiots among the women. And is there one of you who can tell me I am what I am and that's all that I am? Spelled Y-A-M. Eh? I am what I am and that's all right. And that's ne'er the truth was more betterly spoken than that. I mean, I am a war, peace-loving, hate-mongering carnivore. I am what I am, and that's what I am. I mean, you know? I mean, it's very difficult for a fox to stand in front of a group of rabbits and apologize for being a fox when all the rabbits know that he's a fox. And all the foxes know that the rabbits are rabbits. Well, you know, this is all quite convoluted. But these two guys are sitting there. By the way, I got a beautiful postcard the other day. The guy says, "Dear Mr. Shepherd, what is this monotonous drivel that you're droning on and on and on about? When are you going to start making sense and talk about some important things like the news?" Well, I take the point well. One thing about me, I can go to my right. Pretty good here. While I'm sitting on my duffel, there's a thing. You're really interested now in this. I don't want to cause any trouble. Well, actually, seriously, underneath it all, I do want to cause trouble because I am a man. Now, when I say man, I'm saying it in the small sense. That means all of mankind. And not the man that we've played by, you know, that's sad. I'm talking about man. All right, I'm a man. Man, you know, you're a man. Everybody's man. That chick over there, man, you know, mankind. In a mankind sense. So naturally, by definition, we want to cause trouble. And do you really mean right? Do you mean well? I didn't think so. Do you mean well? That's right. I didn't think so either. I could just hear somebody out in Babylon, some friendly little old lady with three cats, a dog, and two ferns, saying, "For heaven's sake, what is it? Of course I mean well. What does he mean?" And she's sitting there, and she's been she's been mongering hate of one kind or another at every card party her family has thrown for the last four generations. But then again, as long as you're going to face it, we might as well. They were sitting there on the shore this lake. For the purposes of the discussion, we'll call one of them Og and the other Charlie. We do not know their actual names. It's been that long. And they're both sitting there, and they're... You know, the interesting thing about man in those days, he crouched more than he does now, which means that he was more honest. He wasn't afraid to crouch down and show the rest of the world that he was afraid of the sky falling in on him. He didn't pretend by keeping his knees flexed. And so he just crouched, and he also knew, you see, that when the sky did fall, there was nothing he could do about it, which is different. We pretend now that we can do something about it. And eternally, every 20 years, the sky has fallen down and killed at least 14 million. Now, we like to pretend that we are a 20th century man. This is, of course, modern civilized man. It's interesting to note that more...
I wish to hear your best information. I want to go back.
In the hand of his
I suggest that you reach deep down inside yourself and there and try and find something that will keep you awake just a little while longer because this transmission coming up may just rekindle your will.
Particular fascination, particularly when we apply it to the things like we really are, like killing everybody. This is true progress. I remember the sad stories, all the sad stories after the war, when they were talking about how atomic energy was going to bring a new age to mankind. It has, actually. Do you notice that haggard look that everybody has? That skulking look that everybody sneaks around with? And now, how many years? 15 years after the first atom bomb was blasted? Well, I mean, we're in the new age, you know. The age of the new ones. But these two guys were crouched down. They were looking out over that dark and placid sea. And they were crouched. I mean, they were legitimately and honestly crouched. And there's another thing about man in that period. He was much more washable than he is now. He was covered with hair. They hadn't discovered, well, the one-minute commercial yet, the singing commercial that told them how terrible it was to smell. And they kind of enjoyed it in those days, oddly enough. It gave them a sense of togetherness, you know, because it was the only real communication that they ever had between one another. They hadn't yet discovered how to really talk. They just sniffed. And so they sat there, and incidentally, that's a very fascinating thing, you see, because no matter how a man's speaking, no matter how orotund his tones, no matter how robust his verse form, no matter how impregnable his society has become, the aroma remains the same. And this, you see, can be taken as, in one sense, the only true universal that exists. And we devote more time and effort in the United States to eradicating that than any other single universal that I know of, which has something to do with I don't know what yet at this time. I'm mulling it over. And we've got it in the mull. We'll see what happens. I mean, we're shaking the dice. We're crumbling the cookie. I figure that the ants will come up one day in some Chinese fortune cookie and let it, you know. But these two guys are sitting there, and they're crouched down. And once in a while, one would shift his position every so slightly, which led to the only noise that was man-created up to that point, which was an occasional cracking knee. A very comforting sound. You know, one of the most comforting things that happened to me in a long time, I had to tell you about my one brief brush with a president. Yes. Well, I sat next to a president one day. The president came in, sat down on this It's a railroad car. So they had a railroad car and these private cars, you know, the leather chairs went around. And I'm sitting there, and the president sat down, and his knee cracked. Oh, my, George. Well, I, you know, I was in fear from this guy. His knees crack. Just like mine. And it kind of made me feel... And, of course, it made me feel two things. One, it made me feel comfortable. Also, scared me. That anybody who is like I am is worth nothing. And really, in a sense, is going to be the end of us all, you see. So I look at him, I says, he's like me. Oh, no, no, of course not. That was my knee I heard cracking. No, his knees don't crack. But I was wrong there. His knees do crack. They do and did crack. And so these two guys are sitting there, once in a while their knees crack. And they're looking out over the sea. This was a historic moment, and is the instant when man became man, M-A-N. Interesting to note that the other day, Henry Morgan made a remark about me. He said, Shepherd is always looking into the past. He's always remembering his childhood. That's true. Sort of proof.
You know, I haven't heard this in a very long time, you know. It feels like the safe zone with Mike Sargent. That's what it feels like. Feels like I'm home. I feel safe. I feel a little naked, too, but you know, I'm saying I got going on. Yeah, okay. You know what I'm thinking about right now? 10 years ago, you and me, Mike, in California. In that apartment. You know, the girl who had that platinum record on the wall? And you said to me, you want to hear something? And I said, what? And you put the headphones on me and it was this. Do you remember?
I do remember.
Great, man.
I thought he was going to say something really juicy. I was sitting there waiting for the, you know, the big ending, but no.
Five minutes. WBAI 99.5 FM. What you heard in the beginning was some of the art and enigma that was Gene Shepherd. What we do here on the radio could easily be called talk radio, because we do talk. Sometimes we talk together, sometimes we talk to listeners. But it is talk radio, and Gene Shepherd is being credited as the inventor of talk radio.
Yeah, I could definitely put him in that arena.
Well, let me just say this. We're going to be talking with an author of a book that just recently came out called Excelsior, you fathead. The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd. That author's name is Eugene Bergman. And you're tuned to listen to sponsored radio WBAI, and this is
Night. Thank you.
But I want to say this about Gene Shepard. A couple of interesting things. Gene Shepard perpetrated one of the great literary hoaxes of all time. He promoted a non-existent book and author, then brought the book into existence. He wrote 23 short stories for Playboy, four times winning the Humor of the Year award. He also interviewed the Beatles for the magazine. He authored popular books of humor. He's a model for the character played by Jason Robards in the play and movie A Thousand Clowns, as well as the inspiration for the Shel Silverstein song made famous by Johnny Cash, A Boy Named Sue. He also is probably most widely known for his creation of A Christmas Story, the popular movie about the kid who wants a BB gun for Christmas and nearly shoots his eye out. So Gene Shepard was a very interesting and complex man. And I think the man who knows him best is Eugene Bergman. Eugene, are you there?
I sure am.
So, Eugene, I'm here with my co-host, Chris.
Hello.
Hello.
And my cousin, Kathy.
How you doing?
Hi.
Now, I have a few questions for you, Eugene. What was your first experience? How did you first experience Gene Shepard? Where were you, and what did it do to you?
Well, I was a college sophomore, and a friend of mine said, hey, there's this absolutely fascinating guy who talks on the radio. So I tuned in. This is when Shepard was on Sunday nights from a few minutes after 9 until 1 in the morning. This is one of his, this is the era of the very laid-back Shepard, who could just use his stream of consciousness technique to the fullest and just almost ramble, just move along at a very slow pace, and as though it were a dorm late at night, or maybe a bar, and it was just you and another guy, and you were having this absolutely fascinating conversation. And that was Shepard. In fact, he was a brilliant conversationalist, except that he was the only one doing the talking.
That's true. He didn't really take calls, did he?
No, virtually none. There was an occasional one, but he certainly never had what one would call a call-in show.
Hmm. And now for you, you said that this was during that evening, and I have another guest who's going to step in here because he's something of a... He considers himself to be a little bit of a Gene Shepard expert himself. You know Max Schmid, don't you?
I sure do.
Max Schmid.
And he is a Gene Shepard expert himself.
Max, are you there?
I'm here.
All right, so here's my question to you. And I'll probably ask you too, Max, the same thing. But I'm much more interested in Eugene than Max. Eugene, what was it for you when you heard this? You described a little bit of, like, you know, being in a college dorm room or in a bar. I mean, had you heard anything like that before?
Well, I suppose any college kid has heard a bit of that between himself and a fellow student, but not on the same high level of intellectual excitement, of feeling that you're, as I like to put it, as though your mind were being tickled on the highest levels. When I say tickled, I mean sort of jogged a little bit, made to react, and of course made to laugh. And there was really nothing like this that you could hear on the radio or see on television or perceive in any other way. He was really unique.
Hmm. And now you say listening to him for you, I mean, you were a fan then? How old were you when you first started listening?
Let's see, I was about 18.
Okay. Now how would you say how has Gene Shepard impacted you in your life? I mean, to write a book about somebody, sure, you can research anybody, but I definitely, from reading your book, I feel you have a great love for everything he did. It's not just a subject to you.
Well, absolutely. It was definitely a labor of love. You know, somebody, as you say, could just write a book, but when Shepard died and I read the obituaries, I thought to myself, I have lost an old friend. A friend that maybe I hadn't paid much attention to in recent years, but here was a guy who affected my thinking, my whole way of perceiving the world, with a certain amount of skepticism, a certain amount of humor. And that's a pretty extraordinary thing, and I'm not unique. You know, many, many people, many thousands of people feel the same way, that the experience of listening to Shepard was one of having your whole way of thinking slightly changed, slightly or more than slightly.
Well, because you had to follow him. That just took you down a path there, I'd say.
Yes.
All right, so now, Max, just to counterpoint what he's saying, what was it for you? I mean, I don't know how you, Max, I have no idea how you got started in radio, but was Dean Shepard influential in your life?
Not a tiny bit. I was around, I grew up during that period, but I even had a friend that was a big fan, but he never told me about it.
Oh.
So I never heard him when he was on the air. I came across...
You discovered him later on.
As a collector.
Mm-hmm.
Got a reel of Gene Shepard shows. I said, oh, let me listen to this. That's pretty good. Let me find some more.
That's interesting.
And I've been finding some more for the last 10 years or so.
Okay, so now you're like a collector. Gene Shepard.
Yeah, I would say I probably have the largest archive that's around, that we know about.
And
that's confirmed.
That's the collective way, of course. Eugene, let me ask you a question now. So in putting together this book, I mean, was this pitched to you? Did you pitch this book? Did you just know it had to be done? Or how long has this been in the making?
Well, a few months after Shepard died, which was in October 99, I began corresponding with an email group that's focused on Shepard. And I began commenting in some of my emails about what I thought about Shepard, because I started listening to more and more many of these shows, which I got from Max. And
He fed your habits.
Yes. And I began making notes of different ideas that I got from Shepard, different themes that Shepard seemed to be promoting, that he would talk about from time to time. And I began filling file folders with these notes, and before you know it, I saw that I had the makings of a book, and I knew just how I wanted this book to be, a combination of the chronology, that is biographical material, and also various themes, chapters that would deal with themes such as his philosophy, etc. And I was then in hot pursuit of putting a book together. One of the areas that I especially found interesting was a chapter I devote to his philosophy, and one of the main things that I found in the philosophical realm was such stories as the Og and Charlie one, and he told some Og and Charlie stories from time to time, and the one you played before is a really great one, and that's one of his from one of his earlier broadcasts. That is, I looked it up in my book as I was listening to it, and I see that it's dated July 31st, 1960. So this is fairly early Shepard, not as early as those Sunday night shows, but it was fairly early Shepard, the really laid-back style, and he was giving a little bit of his philosophy of life, and that, for me, became one of the chapters of the book.
Well, I have to say this. I don't know if it's irony, but the interesting thing for me to read about a man like this and to listen to his tapes, and then to interview you on a radio talk show, it's sort of a perfect, not just a perfect marriage, but it's sort of coming full circle, to be aware of how the form will not only, you talk about how it influenced you, but how he, in a lot of ways, legitimized the form of talk radio and brought it to the forefront and to the point where it was taken to an art. What he did was considered art by so many critics of the day, that in a lot of ways, I think he was very revolutionary.
Yes, he was listened to by many of the major creators in a large number of different art forms.
And many of the other influencers of thought.
Yes, in fact, one of the people I interviewed, David Amram, who is a classical and jazz composer and performer, was a very close friend of Jack Kerouac. And Dave Amram told me that he and Kerouac used to listen to Shepard and appreciate him because he was such a great improviser. And Shepard was really into the jazz scene. He was a close friend of Charles Mingus. In fact, he made a recording with Mingus. He wrote a column on jazz. He was the MC of some major, major jazz performances with Billie Holiday and Mingus and a number of the other greats. So Shepard was really deeply into the creative world of New York in the 50s. And so many people listened to him, appreciated him. Jules Feiffer was a friend of his. Herb Gardner, who wrote 1,000 Clowns, was a close friend. Shel Silverstein, the cartoonist for Playboy and children's poetry writer. He, in fact, was Shepard's closest friend for quite a while. So Shepard was really deeply into the scene.
And interestingly enough, many of the earliest recordings were taped by jazz players. All of the 1960s shows, that the one that we heard the sample from, well, I got all from a jazz musician. I think partially because they liked the music you played under his stuff, and also because they were the people most likely to have a reel-to-reel tape recorder in those days, in 1960 and earlier. How is it you happen to have one, Gene?
Well,
you had some of the earliest recordings ever made of the Shepard Radio Show.
Yes, I was recording him way back in as early as 1956. And it happened.
Wow, you need to put the bass in your voice when you say that. Well, I was recording it way back in 1956.
Well, there aren't any other recordings that go back that early.
There it is.
That we've come upon yet.
Of
his New York work. It happened that my mother was a violinist. She had been a professional classical violinist for a while, and she was just kind of trying to get back into it. So she bought a fairly good tape recorder to record her own violin playing so she could hear it and then improve herself. So I made use of her tape machine.
Is your mom, you said?
Yeah.
Yeah, his mom, yeah. Thanks, Ma.
Right.
All right. So now let me ask you, what was the radio scene, and what was the perception of late-night radio in late 50s, early 60s?
Well, I'm not an expert on the overall scene. I know there were people such as Long John Neville on at the time.
Mm-hmm.
There was some really good jazz disc jockeys.
The make-believe ballroom.
Well, I think that was really on in the afternoon, wasn't it? Or maybe he had a nighttime show.
Mm-hmm.
William B. Williams. And he played a lot of Frank Sinatra and some other of the popular greats.
This is a pre-night shift,
girl. Pre-night shift news.
That was rather different from what Shepard was doing. His own station had a lot of people who talked. Gambling, the gambling dynasty of three generations. There was Dorothy Kilgallen and Dick Calmer and the Fitzgeralds. And all of these people talked during the day, but the way I refer to it, they chatted. No, they did not deal in radio as a real art form the way Shepard did.
What time did his show come on, if you don't mind my asking?
Well, it varied tremendously. When he first, the first Shepard programs that most people think of were those where he began at 1 in the morning and ran through 5:30.
Wow. That's
every weeknight. And unfortunately, nobody has come up with recordings of those yet. I'm hoping that as my book becomes known and people start thinking about, oh my goodness, I used to listen to him. I made some recordings.
Do you have a website? Do you have a website like for people to connect on this?
Well, definitely there's a marvelous website called FlickLiv. FlickLiv.com. There's a tremendous amount of material on Shepard in all phases of his art. In fact, Max's programs themselves, where he rebroadcast Shep, are archived, at least 8 or 10 of them, the most recent ones.
Who, Max Mead?
Yes, you can listen to
Max Mead? Is archived?
If you can't stay up till 5:15 to hear the show live on the air, you can listen to them for weeks afterwards at FlickLiv.com.
There it is.
So he was on from 1 to 5:30, and until he got fired for playing no music and just talking.
He got fired?
He got fired.
I hear you. That's something.
That's a commonplace thing in our lives, I guess. You know.
What year is that?
That'd have been 70-something, wasn't it?
Well, he was fired in 1956 in the middle of the year sometime, I think in late July or beginning of August. The story is that he said that the general manager said to him, you need to play more music. And Shepard said, everybody plays music. People want to hear the human voice. So the general manager said, you will play music tonight or you're out of here. So Shepard said, I didn't play any music at all. So they cut him off the air.
That's intense.
Didn't he get fired over the Sweetheart Soap thing? Or was
it's kind of a combination of things. I believe that once he was fired, they let him come back on the air for a few more days. And they also claimed that he was not commercial. So he said to his listeners, let's come up with a product. And let's, all of you guys and gals, go out and ask for this product. Let's show that my listeners indeed do buy things. And let's see, what'll it be? Let's say Sweetheart Soap. Everybody go out and buy Sweetheart Soap. And the general manager was listening that night, and he was cut off the air again because Sweetheart Soap was not a sponsor. The very nice ending of that story is that although he was off the air for a couple of days, Sweetheart Soap contacted WOR and said, oh, well, yeah, we'll sponsor him. And then WOR had to frantically try and find Shepard, who was in hiding somewhere, and they finally found him and said, come on back. And that's when he came back on Sunday nights from 9 to 1 in the morning, and that's when I began listening.
Wow. Gene Shepard seems like a Patty Chayefsky character in a lot of ways. So you can still listen to Sponsored Radio, WBAI, 99.5 FM, and we're talking about Gene Shepard, who is, among other things, one of the inventors and innovators of talk radio from the 50s into the, was it mid to late 70s he was on the air still?
So April 1st, 1977.
Wow. Also the creator of A Christmas Story. Mm-hmm. Did you want to take a couple calls to see what people may want to ask you about Gene Shepard or anything?
That would be fine.
All right. Well, we're going to hear a little of Gene Shepard, and we're going to take a couple calls. You tuned to Listener Sponsored Radio, WBAI. The name of the show is Night Shift.
Come on, all together now, gang. God, thanks, you're slowing up there. Let's go, keep it going. That's it, there we go. Take it up there.
What a cacophony. Gallimaufry. Which reminds me, this is WOR, AM at FM, New York. Silly, idiotic radio station. By the way, speaking of silly, idiotic radio station, did you see that ad for the Limelight Show? Did you see it? Did you see that ad in this morning's Times for the Limelight? You didn't see that ad? Oh, gee, that's too bad. It was right there on the whole front thing there on page something of the Times for the Limelight. It's a great ad, yeah. And as a demonstration, I would like to have at least 10% of you out there tomorrow to show the WOR show that in spite of that ridiculous ad, you'll still come out. I'll tell you this. 10 minutes after that ad hit the paper, my lawyer was on the phone. Idiotic, ridiculous. Did you see that ad? You didn't really? Crying out loud. $87 million for an ad, nobody saw it. All I have to do is make one boo-boo on this microphone, and 8,000 guys will call up. I can win the Pulitzer Prize, the Peabody Award, and an Emmy here. Nothing. Yeah, that's right. Hit it again, Dad. And for those of you who... No, it was a great ad. Seriously speaking, friends, as Bert Park so beautifully put it. If you are interested, though, tomorrow night at 10 o'clock, we are going to be on for 2 solid hours emanating live, pulsatingly, from the Limelight down in the Village. And if you want to come and make that scene, you better get down there early. They have room for 7 people in that place. It's a roaring joint. And it's on Sheridan Square, and we go on the air at 10, and we're there until midnight. And it will be live, and it will be every week, too, by the way. So if you'd like to, it's probably going to be the cheapest date in town. And we'll be there. And what am I going to do? Well, that's what they're all asking around here. Well, I don't know what we're going to do, Tony. I have an idea. I know one thing. They're setting up the tank down there for my underwater ballet, and I'll be on with that. I've got my temp. No, I've worked up a lot of choreography and things. It's going to be all right. Just don't worry about it. I got a couple of things going on. I've got this little table that I'm going to set up. I haven't used it since the fall of 48. It's this little table with the green felt top, and I got 3 walnut shelves. There's a lot of interesting things that we're going to do down there, and I just suggest you bring a couple of bucks, and we'll have a few games of chance, and we'll talk over old times and stir up a little action there. One thing I will say, though, ties are not allowed. No, that's true. That's true. I promise. But you know, speaking of problems and St. Valentine's Day, as long as we're on the subject, we might as well go all out and admit to a few things. And before we do that, let's get a couple of commercials off the log here. First of all, we have the Pottery of All Nations. And if you have not visited the Pottery of All Nations, I would highly suggest a visit. They have pottery from all over the world. And if you don't have a pot to, they've got pottery of all kinds there. They're down on Sheridan Square. And just go in and ask Larry, say, "Hey, Larry, I don't have a pot." And Larry will say, "Okay," and reach up on the upper shelf around the back. They keep those in the back by over the ovenware there. And you'll find a visit to the Pottery of All Nations is well worth it. They let you break things, and they have beautiful Chinese oriental imitation mandarin vases, many things there that are particularly indigenous to the art attitudes of the upper Bronx on the upper areas of Fordham Road there near Tellum Parkway. And now they have one store on Sheridan Square, and they're open Saturdays, one on 64th and Lexington, which only opens when things are looking good in that neighborhood, and then there's one over on Route 4 in Paramus. Okay, Pottery of All Nations. It's the place to go if you don't have a pot to... Will you quit cutting me off, you idiot? If I'm going to get cut off, it's going to be my problem, not yours. You're just an engineer. You stay in there and run that thing, will you? 1, 2, 3, 4, off, for crying out loud. What do you, that's the only good thing I've said tonight. Well, for those of you who are interested, we'll get around this clown. For those of you who are interested in it, send your name and address to Censor, WOR, AM, and FM, New York. Censor. And you must be over 21. We'll include it. It's especially interesting for art students. 50 poses. And, good Lord. You know, speaking of, because we better get with the Philharmonic before we go any further. With the Philharmonic here, Sunday at 3 p.m., WR invites you to listen to the 20th broadcast of the season. This is a very obstinate group that's still on the New York Phil.
Oh, well, I could see many things coming in 75 that I'm looking forward to. And I'm looking forward to a new day. You know, it's a note of hope that's in my voice.
I'm glad you decided to join us.
Thank you.
Speak with Eugene B. Bergman, who's the author of Excelsior, You Fathead, which is the art and the name of Gene Shepard. That was Gene Shepard we just heard there. And I have to say, more and more, he sounds like a Petachevsky character to me. So, what was happening in that period? Eugene?
How do you mean? I'm not quite sure I understand the question.
No, I'm saying, what period was this in his career? Was this in the 60s, 70s? Where was he? Was it WOR?
He said 75.
No, 75?
It's a jump ahead to the next cut. This was actually 1964, plugging the first show of the Saturday Night Limelight show.
Oh, that's right.
Gotcha.
That's right.
February, April, I forget. Sometime early 64.
Right. He was only at the Limelight for a couple of years there.
Well, you're tuned to listen to Sponsored Radio, WBAI. We're speaking with Eugene Bergman, who is the author of Excelsior, You Fathead, the new book on Gene Shepard, 212-209-2900. And we have a few more minutes. We're going to have him on until 1 a.m., and you can ask him questions. Hello, you're on the air.
Oh, great. I'm glad I got through. I was a big fan of Gene Shepard. I remember the Creeping Meatballers and Mad Comics. That's when I first heard about him. And I used to hear him on the radio all the time. And we went to a rally. My sister and I went to a rally once at Needick's. I don't know if you remember Needick's.
Needick's.
They used to have Orange Drink.
Yeah, they were competing with Nathan's.
Okay, right. Now, they closed down. I think they've been out of business for years. But at this rally, I remember, he did this little jingle. It was Needick's, Double Beedick's, Tipkins All Agree, Orange, Frankens, Goodens, Eatons, Best That There Can Be. And my sister brought a dictionary because he always said the word rutabagas was a fraud. It was a word in English language. So she opened the dictionary up to the word, and he wrote in the dictionary an obvious forgery. Now, I wish I could find that because it must be worth a fortune, right? It's his handwriting. It's his handwriting.
Oh, wow. He wrote it. And you have that?
I don't know. I can't find it. My sister may have it, actually. If it's still around, probably through. But he was a character. I loved him, man. He was, like you said, one of the early iconoclasts and great raconteur. I mean, that was his specialty. He could sit there and just rap some great stories, and you never got bored because he was brilliant. He was cool. I mean, he was the meaning of him, in my opinion. And that's why he never made big bucks, except maybe the Christmas Story made a little money.
Now, sir,
yeah.
Did you have a question for Eugene?
Oh, I do. Well, I wanted to relate this to him for his, you know, golf cars, because I don't know if you knew about the old Needick rally, the little jingle I related, if you were familiar with that. Well, back to the question. How's that? Does he know that jingle I related about Needick?
Gene?
I've definitely heard that, and
you know it all.
What that sounds like is one of Gene Shepard's mills. He would ask his listeners to just sort of gather someplace and mill around, not do anything in particular, not especially say anything, but just sort of discomfort the uninitiated by walking around and doing not much of anything.
That's right. But this was actually a promo for me. Somewhere down there.
That's kind of what we do here, yeah.
I loved it. And he was
motivating the others to uninitiate.
Max is an expert, definitely. I love him. If I'm up at 4 in the
morning. Max is one of the uninitiated.
He's
also an expert.
He's an expert. I've heard him play Gene Shepherd when I can't sleep at 4 a.m. And I love listening. I love listening to him because he's... What did he die of? That's another question. How old was he when he passed away?
I don't think that's public knowledge.
Kidding.
It was definitely natural
age,
course.
Really.
But I mean, he wasn't that young, or was...
He was really
78.
78? Well, that's pretty decent. That's average. You know, a little above me. For a male.
Did he smoke? Did Gene smoke?
I can't hear you too well.
Eugene, I'm saying, did Gene Shepherd smoke?
He did earlier on, say, in the 60s, there are shots of him smoking a cigar, and...
Yeah, there's some shows where he talks about it for about a week. I don't know how long he kept it up.
But he was smoking.
So, Max, you listened from what year were you listening to? You didn't listen...
I heard it only once when it was actually broadcast.
Okay.
But since then...
It's all on tape.
And what year did he die?
99. October.
Oh, he died in 99.
99.
Yeah, but he had been semi-retired in Florida for about 20 years at that point, working on motion pictures, of course.
So he experienced the whole success of Christmas Story and everything with the
PBS. They made a subsequent movie or two.
They didn't
really do well.
No, but I don't know if he...
Of course, they had Charles Grodin as the old man, which didn't help. But.
Right.
By the way, are you familiar with the creepy meatballism in the Mad comics?
That was the only time they adapted Shepherd. Other radio types like Bob and Ray were in Mad a lot more.
Yeah, Bob and Ray.
Bob and Ray and Steve Allen.
They borrowed works and had them illustrated. Some of the very few articles that if you buy the complete Mad on CD-ROM, as I did, you'll turn to those pages and say, due to copyright issues, this is the one article we can't reprint. But you can't get the Shepherd.
Are you kidding?
No.
Not reprinted?
Well, there is a website that has all of the articles that were not reprinted in the CD-ROM set.
All right, well, the phones are lining up.
All right, great
show,
man. And you brought back so many great memories and nostalgias of Lower Beauty.
All right.
Thanks. You. I love your show, Mike, and I've been listening 25
years. Oh, really?
I'm a fan, very fun.
Yeah. You've been listening to the Night Shift for 25
years?
Yeah.
Go on. How long you want a year?
We've been on about 20 years. 15 years. 15.
No, no.
It only seems like 20 years.
I've been listening to the AI since 68.
Wow. So you listened to the first Night Shift show?
I may have. Who knows? I doubt it. But I've been listening. I've been listening for a long time.
Did we listen?
You weren't on. The lady
was on.
I was on.
He wasn't
on. Okay, maybe some. I don't remember.
Well, we used to be on at 3:30 in the morning on Thursday.
The sexy broads you got on.
We used to be on the 60. Oh, we got a whole sexy broad thing going on.
Oh, yeah.
It was just a new element.
Yeah.
Of course.
We're trying to keep up with the
time. Thank you, sir.
Hello, young man. Sexy broad.
Yeah, hi there.
Hi, how are you?
All right. My name is Robert.
Hey, Robert.
Hi, Robert.
I called Gene Shepherd as a ham radio operator and amateur radio.
Uh-huh.
And I don't remember what his call letters were.
K2R something.
K2ORS.
Mm. Oh, he must have gotten the reassigned since I heard him. I think you're going to try K2. ORX?
S. S in Sam.
Yeah. Oh, because they didn't hand out A's. One by three A's until later on.
K2.
K2. All right. Okay.
Yeah.
K2ORS. All
right. Right.
And he addressed, he was the keynote speaker entertainment at a large convention that they had up in upstate New Jersey, northern New Jersey, at one of the hotels. And there was just hundreds of people in the banquet room after the banquet. He addressed everyone and went into, you know, an hour-long show. It was great. It was absolutely great. And, you know, relating all about amateur radio and different funny stories and all. I think that was about 1978, maybe.
Interesting is that he was such an obsessive talker that if he wasn't talking on the radio... He was talking to whatever individual he could collar in his studio or on the street or anywhere. And when he went home at night, he'd be talking on ham radio.
Yeah,
just couldn't stop him from talking.
That sounds like Chris, you know. He's like that. I leave the show.
But he brought to attention at the convention how people who converse on amateur radio with Morse code, which is becomes like another language as you become adept at it. It almost sounds like someone is talking to you. And
someone's talking to you now, man.
No, yeah, here we go.
I can hear those.
He was explaining about it, and it's true how the person who was an amateur radio operator and is adept at this Morse code always answers after a delay. You know, you ask the person a question, and then there'll be this pause with no sounds at all coming from him, and then all of a sudden he'll answer the question. You know. And the reason being is that the after a period of time you I don't know, it's your brain is like befuddled by this, and you're copying behind, you know, because you're copying your head. If you're really adept at it, it just sounds like somebody talking to you, and you allow enough time for them to switch over from the transmitter, you know, to the receiver.
Mm-hmm.
But that was one of the funny parts of his show. Is what he was going on about that. Well, I don't think he was much of a Morse code operator. I don't believe.
Probably didn't have the patience.
Well, no,
he did learn it.
Yeah. Oh yeah, of course he learned it. Yeah,
You have to learn it to get the license. And
back
actually,
then.
One of my favorite stories is about how, as a kid, he claimed that he could do 40 words a minute, but he got into a race with somebody at the other end who could do 60 words a minute.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what happens if you try to. Got to be too smart about it, yeah.
And what Shepard did was he turned this incident of his childhood, on the assumption that it was a true incident, that into a little parable about how everyone has to see that they have limits, that there's somebody out there that's better than you are. And here was this guy who could do 60 words a minute without stop and without error. And Shepard, as a kid, learned that he had limits and that there were people out there far, far better than he could ever be.
Eugene, let me ask you something, Eugene. I grew up listening to Long John Neville, and I got to hear a couple of Dean shows in, I think, 74, around that time. But I listened to a lot of Long John and was very influenced by Long John Neville. What would you like people to most remember that you've taken from all of this, from writing this book and all of this, that you want people to most remember about Gene, that they can keep as an encapsulation in their brain to be, like, really motivated to explore more of Gene?
Well, I would say that what he did for listeners was give you an approach to the world, which had a combination of great joy in the diversity and marvelous things in the world, and yet to have a skepticism, which he encapsulated in the phrase, keep your knees loose, meaning you never know what's going to happen, so you better be ready for anything.
Well, the book is called Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepard. The author is Eugene Bergman. And how long did it take you to put this book together?
Well, the basic manuscript only took about a year or so, but then I kept working on it as I was seeking a publisher. And when I finally got a publisher, they asked to have me interview people, and that took the better part of a year. So 3 or 4 years of writing, and then trying to get it published and get it out there.
Well, it's Excelsior, You Fathead. It's available now. It comes out from Applause Books. You can get it on Amazon or anything, pretty much. And when did it actually hit the streets, as it were?
Well, Amazon has been selling it for a while, but the official publication date was March 28th.
Okay, so we're a couple weeks in. Let me ask you, I hope you'd come back again.
Second printing, by the way.
You were second printing already?
Yes. Ooh. I was so excited the other day.
Wow. Damn. Awesome. Got a second print? Awesome.
Where actually he got the title of the book?
Oh, that's a famous quote from
Gene Terry.
Well, I don't know anything about Gene Terry. I'm just hearing about him, learning about him tonight.
Well, would you like me to talk about the title?
Please.
Well, Excelsior in Latin means something to the effect of onward and upward to victory. And there's a Longfellow poem by that name about a young idealistic fellow who goes up a mountainside and in a blizzard. And people say, no, no, you'll die up there. But he says, oh, I must. And he's carrying a banner that says Excelsior. So there's a sense of idealistic optimism. Mm-hmm. And that's undercut by Shepard's adding, you fathead, meaning, sure, have some idealism and try and go onward and upward. But if you're too idealistic and don't have any realism, you are a fool. So Excelsior, you fathead, kind of encapsulates Shepard's view of life.
And the enigma that he was.
Well, let me ask you one last question, Eugene. We always ask this. What did you learn about yourself from working on this whole process of this book? Did you learn anything that you'd like to share with us through this whole journey that you went through yourself in making this book?
Well, I learned that putting a book together is a lot more difficult than I ever thought it was. It was a great pleasure, but I learned that there was a tremendous amount of work and sacrifice in other areas of my life. But basically, it was worth it, and I'm certainly glad I did it, and I'd do it again.
Did you learn anything more about Gene from doing this one?
Well, I certainly learned a lot more about the rather negative aspects of his personality, mm-hmm. something that most fans really, I think, would have preferred not to learn, but I think it's probably true of many great creators that they have a flaw in them that that makes them not quite God.
I'm kind of interested in this for a second here. What exactly did you want to give us a little bit of a tidbit here?
About the
about his negative side, maybe, or something that was
about the dark side.
Yeah.
Well, for one thing,
because he was a true genius, and there is a balance, I guess.
Absolutely. Well, a lot of people found that he could be rather nasty to them. You know, sometimes he was a marvelous person, and other times he would be rather unpleasant. A major thing is that he was quite a mentor to tens of thousands of youngsters listening to him, almost a father figure. And yet, he had two children that he not only usually would ignore, but at times actually denied. And that's rather sad.
Wow. Intense. You know, a fascinating thing, when they were making an adaptation, it came before A Christmas Story, it was Phantom of the Open Hearth that they did for PBS. And the actor asked him, well, how should I play the old man? And he said, well, here's the kind of guy he is. He's the kind of guy who a year from now is going to leave his family and go off to the high life in Chicago. And that's what his father did. And that's also what he ended up doing. He just left the wife and children, hooked up with an actress, and just turned his back on the original family.
Oh, an actress. Shameless.
Well, I could name her. Probably in the book, right?
Come on, in the book.
Lois Nettleton.
Lois Nettleton from, she was in one of the James Bond movies.
Was she?
Well, she's been in a lot of things, and she's still active.
Yeah, Lois Nettleton, anyway. What was she in? I know her from something. I know the name. Was she on a TV show?
I don't know her career other than I know she was in one Seinfeld episode.
No, she had something she was doing before that.
But she wouldn't talk for the book, eh?
Well, you know, I had read an article saying that she simply did not want to talk about Shepard. So, now, subsequently, I found that she was indeed interviewed by somebody, and she was quite open and happy to talk about him. So I'm hoping that sometime I'll be able to talk with her and learn some more.
What do you got in the works now for yourself now from what are you heading into next?
Well, I think I'll always have some shepherd work to do, but one of the other things that I've done is I've written a one-man play about shepherds.
Really?
That I would love to see performed somewhere. And I think it brings out some of the negative enigma of his life, and it also brings out some of the joy and the genius.
And well,
so Shepard, I think, is always going to be a major part of my thinking and probably a significant part of my writing for the rest of my life.
Mm. You know what I think is cool about Mr. Bergman here? You know what he did before he retired? What did
you do before you retired?
He designed all of the sets and the displays at the Museum of Natural History.
Well,
get out of here!
I designed a number of them. I designed Amphibian and Reptile Hall.
Mm. The designer of the Amphibian Hall.
I worked with Dr. Margaret Mead on her Pacific People's Hall.
Oh,
I designed that.
Wow,
I designed the South American People's Hall, so I had a pretty interesting career. It was absolutely fascinating for 34 years.
Wow, that's awesome.
So this is your first book?
Yes, my first published book. I've got a couple of unpublished literary novels.
No, literary masterpieces.
I've got a couple unpublished masterpieces.
Sit on your shelf.
That's right.
You wrote a couple bestsellers.
You could start working on Mike Sargent's book.
Well, let's say there are potential bestsellers.
No.
You want to sell your book.
Positive, sir.
Be positive.
All right, well,
one more question about the Christmas Story.
Quick
did
question.
Did you realize the impact of that movie or the book / movie?
This is Elena, the late co-host, and she said it's her favorite movie.
It is my favorite. I've seen it 40, 50 times. And
I'll have to get you copies of some of the earlier works. The things they did on PBS are better than
the movie to watch or something.
Quotes from this movie.
Watching the same one over and over again.
Are included in my included in my senior annual.
Are we ordering some Chinese food? Here, I want some spare ribs.
Well, what was your question?
Did you realize how much... I mean, maybe y'all didn't work as into it.
Are you asking a question?
Yes. I'm just so obsessed.
Oh, my God.
But this movie, did he realize how much he had done for certain people that really were influenced by the narrative of that particular book?
Well, he was definitely proud of having made a movie. Very, very proud of it. And... It pretty well made him rich. In fact, he did an episode, one of his episodes in a series called Gene Shepherd's America is titled Filthy Rich at Last. And it probably refers to the fact that he made so much money out of A Christmas Story. So he enjoyed it. He enjoyed making movies, and he was very happy that he was filthy rich at last.
However, when the film opened, they rushed it out of the theaters. It did hardly any business at all.
Well.
And they rushed it out because the same company had another picture that they were trying to promote, and they wanted the theaters. I can't remember what the other picture was.
Probably a Travolta picture.
No, I think it was Walking Tall or Billy Jack or something. I'm kidding.
Well, you know, the story is that when they made the film, that the studio did not want to release it, according to the director. So the director said, I'll buy it from you. So they finally released it, but by the time they got around to it, it was so close to the Christmas season, there were only about 100 theaters that had an opening for it.
I remember hearing something like that. Is it Lois Nettleton or Nettleton?
Nettleton.
Nettleton. Ah, here we go. She was in something. Something sci-fi. I've got to find out where it is. I know her. I know her from somewhere.
Oh, okay.
All right. Well, she was in the TV show In the Heat of the Night. Let's see. Uh-huh. She was in Dirty Dingus McGee.
Oh, she was in Dirty Dingus McGee. Now, when do you get to see that?
Exactly. Dirty Dingus McGee. She was in Meet Me in St. Louis.
What? Who was she in Meet Me in St. Louis?
I have. In Meet Me in St. Louis, she was who knows? They didn't say.
What?
They didn't say. She was in Deadly Blessing with Maren Jensen from Battlestar Galactica. Just so you know.
One of the highlights of the radio show tonight. Right now, we're in the middle.
All right, well, you're tuned to listen to Sponsored Radio, WBAI 99.5. The name of the show is Night Shift. We've been talking with the author of Excelsior, you fathead. A bunch of people are still trying to call. You want to take one more call before you go, Eugene?
Sure.
Okay, we'll take one more call. Let's keep trying to call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, Eugene.
Hello.
Hey, Eugene. I'm a staff sergeant, and I eat my penis.
Oh, that's nice.
Bon appetit. It's late at night in New York. Keep that in mind. Hello, you on the air.
That's
hello, you on the air. Okay. What's the phone number here, Elena?
212-209-2900.
Hello, you on the air.
Hey, people.
Yes?
Lois Nelson, I believe, was on an episode of the original Star Trek, The Blonde.
There it is. There you go, folks.
Star Trek. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you.
Michael.
He's
vindicated.
You.
He can rest.
Hello, you on the air.
You see what
phone number here is what? 212-209-2900.
212-209-2900.
Talking to Eugene Bergman. I hope that this book makes you filthy rich and
wealthy. Thank you, Eugene.
I hope so. Hello, you on the air. Thank you. Max, here. They thank you in the they. They, all the... The Eugene, they thank you in the beginning of the book. Hello, you're in the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm retired now, but between 1956 and 1961, I was a transmitter engineer and studio engineer for WOR.
Mm.
And from time to time, I was the board engineer for Gene Shepard.
Wow, what's your name, sir?
Yes, if you could.
I'd rather not.
That's okay.
What's your first name?
How about?
When did he call you on the
engineer
air? When he yelled at you?
X. And,
Engineer X. Can we call you Engineer X?
The only bond I ever had with him was that I'm a ham radio operator also. But he was one of the most difficult talent I have ever worked with.
Was he an ornery bastard?
I don't think that's a nice way to characterize him. He was a very difficult person, and he always seemed to feel that night radio was a modus vivendi for him, and he was meant for bigger things, whether it was real theater or real producing, and the off Broadway or the night radio was just this kind of stepping stone. And I mean, he would make a big show about how much prep he would put into the program.
What's your first name?
I'd really rather
not. He's Engineer X. I don't think your first name would be that big a deal.
So he would take it out on the people around him that
and
he...
And in fact, I was at Caucus for a while, and he was such a difficult person that I moved to the transmitter at Empire and subsequently moved on. But he was really a tough guy.
But when you were engineering him, were you out at the actual...
Well, part of
the transmitter?
In the early days, he was at the transmitter as well.
Mm. But describe that, because I don't think people realize... what that was all about at night.
Yeah, I mean, it was like a closet with a microphone in it. It was so they could shut down the studios.
But I mean, this was not in Manhattan, the studios. They actually broadcast from the swamp in New Jersey.
Yeah, right. But that was not uncommon in those days. Similarly, at Empire, you would have a telephony chain, 60-millimeter chain. You could shut down the studios, and it'd be a little booth for somebody to... the veggie chopper commercials or whatever they were.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, I used to...
What floor is the studio on at the Empire?
Probably it was about 86, I guess. It was where the transmitter was.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was...
That's where BII is to this day.
Yeah, I know. I was just up there. Go ahead.
Go ahead, sir. Did you ask? What were you going to say?
Well, it kind of slipped my mind.
But wrong.
The thing is that there's, you know, after I left WOR Radio, which had these beautiful Continental transmitters, it was a beautiful facility and everything. And I worked with Gambling for a while and Peggy Fitzgerald for a while.
The father or the son?
Well, Well, what you're referring to now is the grandson of the great-grandson.
All right. I'm thinking the grandson's on now, but I mean,
he's on WABC, right-wing radio, we call it.
Mm.
But the thing is, I would listen to him into the 60s, and is Max Mead one of the people that's there?
Yeah, Max Mead is here.
Yeah. You might agree with this, but I think somewhere around 65 or so, Shepard really lost it. I don't know. They chopped his time up, and I don't know what happened. But I
think it was later that he lost it, but Eugene likes his stuff from the 1960 and earlier.
Yeah.
And I think from 66 to 69 was his prime, really.
Really?
65 to 69, maybe.
Well, I don't know, but anyway, there are a lot of people that are very, what's the word, adulatory about him. And, you know, he was just a short, gruff guy. I don't know why. I'm trying to remember what her name was. Edith Brown or somebody that stuck.
Lee
Brown, right, yeah. Lee, yeah. I don't know why she stuck with him, because he was really irascible. And he would beat up on the crew, partly because he was a ham himself, and he knew more about the technology than most people did. And he would do weird things. He would use cardioid microphones and use the back of them and so on. And he would do that so he could sound far away. If you come in and turn the microphone around, he would go around and he'd sit so his back was to the back to the control.
I like that.
Yeah.
Well, he was a genius with sound. He loved to play around with sound and get all kinds of effects.
I'll tell you two people that he respected tremendously. One was Raymond Scott. And the other one was Les Paul.
Les Paul, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I know.
Come on, Les.
I don't know if you know who Raymond Scott was.
No, who's Raymond Scott?
Oh, come on.
Fool me.
Well, Raymond Scott was the guy that built probably the very first electronic synthesizer.
And he also wrote Powerhouse and a million cartoon backgrounds.
Right. But he wrote a lot of that. He built the machine so he could play it, he could play his own tunes. Yeah, he did. Hey,
Columbia Records. They had a compilation of Raymond Scott.
Soothing Sounds for Babies.
Yeah.
But that was other work.
And
electronic stuff.
And Shepard.
Les Paul, obviously, genius behind,
Shepard
early recording.
Shepard was technically very astute. I mean, I remember one day he came in with a switched-on Bach record that was done by Walter Carlos.
Who later became
Wendy Carlos, right? And
that's a great album.
And he was the first. Shepard was the first person I ever heard about
playing that on the air.
About Moog.
Mm-hmm.
And the first person I ever heard about Ray Dolby, and of course I was a studio engineer. I'd never heard of Ray Dolby, or for that matter, Tommy Dowd, a name which probably is not familiar to you.
Yes, I was. Ray Dolby, of course.
Yeah, and Tommy Dowd also probably one of the most famous recordings.
Dowd, yeah. I have like one of those audio mix magazines. Tommy Dowd, standing there with the beard.
Yeah.
So did you have any great experience with him at all? Was something like
I never had a positive experience.
Wow.
But you were aware of the power of his talent.
I as my grandson says in the internet world these days, he was a legend in his own domain.
Mm. Mm.
All right, I'm gonna say 73, gentlemen.
Thank you, sir.
Can I ask you just one more question?
He's gone. No more questions for you, Elena. No more questions.
He's an engineer we were just listening to, and Shepard indeed was not very happy with most of his engineers.
Yeah, he felt that
they didn't pay enough attention.
1, 2, 3, 4, off. Like, okay. I see what you think of me.
There were times when he would make really nasty remarks about his engineers.
That we heard
on the air.
Yeah. Mm. Well, Eugene, I want to say that it has been actually pretty interesting and fascinating. Like, Max gave me two DVDs chock full of Gene Shepard. I was ready to, like, totally gorge on him, and they don't play on anything that I own.
They're waiting files, Mike.
I left them waiting files. They don't even show up. It's not played this day.
Get out of technology.
I have all kinds of technology. Just trust
me. We don't have anything.
But anyway. Eugene, I've totally enjoyed you being here. I would like to bring you on again if you'd be open to do that.
I'd be delighted.
Okay. Well, you tend to listen to Sponsored Radio, WBAI 99.5 FM, and this is Night Shift. Max, anything you want to say in closing?
Well, tune in 5:15 for a complete episode of Gene Shepherd from 1965, as yet to be determined.
Thank God for people like Max Mees.
Thank you, man.
Yeah. Well, stick in there, friend. Just keep your old knees loose. Just keep your hands ready and supple. Do a little finger exercises once in a while. You want to be able to pick up those fast ground balls, you know, when they hit them down at you. You don't want to muff your only chance. You'll ever get only one in this ball game. You'll ever catch it in the teeth. You don't want to do that. Oh, there's no worse feeling than to charge in on a ground ball in front of 42,000 people and have it roll right up your arm and into your ear. I have seen that happen. Terrible feeling, I'll tell you. Especially when you got a 5 3/4 size head. You know, a little pin type thing there sitting on the top of your head. So be of good cheer, friends. And once in a while, when you're in the job, just holler as loudly as you can, bah, humbug. Try it. It does good to clear out the pipes. Just keep the record straight a little bit there. And speaking of the record, we'll be on tomorrow night live as a jaybird from the Limelight. 10:30 until midnight here.